Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a longtime journalist, political analyst, historian, and author. Last year, Thomas Frank penned a book called Listen Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People? The book looks at the shifting political and moral center of the Democratic Party, a party that once stood for the people and for addressing issues of inequality and social injustice. It's quietly moved away from those issues, even though they still talk a big game. So are the Democrats still the party of the people? And in this new political climate where Republicans reign, where do Democrats fit in? Thomas Frank is the best-selling author of What's the Matter with Kansas and a writer for The Guardian and a co-founder of The Baffler. Thomas Frank, my guest at the big table tonight. We're going to talk politics, identity, inequality. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. You know, I love this city, by the way.
Well, you have roots in this city.
I lived here for 15 years.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Is it great to come back? You feel good?
I love it. I love this place. It feels like, you know, well, I'm a Midwesterner, born in Kansas City, you know, and this is where I belong. Unfortunately, I live in Washington these days.
I was going to say. We'll get into that. Your past work, you know, and I talk about What's the Matter with Kansas, but I mean, a lot of the trilogy of books that you put together, you know, was really looking at the Republican and the conservatives' fascination with the 1% and how that's sort of taken over the party. What drew you to writing about the other side, writing about the Democrats?
Well, it's a two-party system in this country. So when you say, you know, the Republicans are victorious or we're living in a Republican era or we're still in the age of Reagan or whatever, there's all these different ways of describing it. There's another side to that story. And you look at the situation that we're in today where inequality, you know, President Obama used to talk about inequality, but this is something that we all understand. We can see it happening in our everyday lives that wages never go up and you know, and meanwhile, the people at the top are living in these fantastic McMansions and all this sort of thing. We're in an age of incredible inequality, and yet the Republicans are completely dominant in our national politics. And the party of the – supposedly the party of the left, which ought to be doing very, very well in a time like this, is flat on its back.
Right.
I mean, wiped out across the board. You know, it's not just Hillary losing the presidency to – Donald Trump, it's Congress, Supreme Court, state legislatures, and it's a wipeout.
Local government, I mean, here in Illinois, Bruce Rauner is the governor.
Yep, the Democrats are in the weakest state they've been in my entire lifetime. I was born in the mid-60s. They're weaker today than they've been at any time since the 1920s.
It's fascinating, too, because you wouldn't necessarily think that coming off a two-term presidency, one that ran on hope and one that was historical in its nation.
Yeah.
I mean, but hope plays a big role in the book.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, but to talk about that, I mean, because it seems that the Democrats still cling to the idea of being the party of the people, using words and ideas that seem to – the rhetoric seems to relate to an audience.
Well, that was their brand identity. In a lot of ways, they've lost it. But, I mean, let's talk about you mentioning Barack Obama and the Age of Hope. You know, he came into office in 2008. I was a very enthusiastic Barack Obama supporter. By the way, I had lived in Hyde Park, and he was my state senator. And you used to see him at house parties. And I thought in 2008, you know, global financial crisis, you have this administration of George W. Bush, the hacks and the cronies, you know, these fools in charge of these agencies. You know, they can't see a hurricane coming down, bearing down on New Orleans. They can't figure that out. They let Wall Street just do whatever they want. So here comes Barack Obama. And I look at this guy and I say, this is the Franklin Roosevelt of my generation. I was prepared to see him. I did see him as a hero. You know, here he comes to Washington to set matters straight. And he has the smarts and he has the skills. And he basically, on the most important question of our time, which is what to do about Wall Street, he continued the policies of the Bush administration. And the, you know, inequality. And look, I don't want to detract too much from Barack Obama. In some ways, I think I still think he's a great man, a heroic figure even. But he did disappoint people who had expectations like I had for him. I mean, and that's a lot of people. I mean, we thought we were heading into another 1930s, you know. Here comes the leader who is going to fix these problems for us. And inequality has gotten worse in his term in office. You know, the Wall Street bonuses are back where they were. You know, they're still a colossus astride the world. By the way, the recession is still going on in some countries. Spain, Greece, Italy. This is crazy.
Barack Obama fits the profile of the new Democrat, this socially liberal politician who will usher in new eras of gay marriage and other social. But when
he
comes to
on that,
exactly. But when you talk about the economy or inequality or money in any form,
or let's say organized labor, you know,
very.
If you want to talk about by the way, I mean, and regardless of what listeners think about unions, you want to talk about something that would put inequality into reverse. It would be allowing people to form unions again, which is essentially impossible in America today. And Obama had that in his hands and let it go. I'll throw another one out there. Antitrust. You know, we are living in a new age of monopoly, like the 19th century. We're going back to the 19th century in all sorts of ways. It was fully within Barack Obama's power to reverse that. Didn't do it, even after the Republicans got Congress. But, you know, on the issue of what to do about the Wall Street banks, he had many, many, many options before him, and he chose the one that did the least to these guys.
Why? I mean, when you think about that, and you think about that as a liberal or a Democrat who voted for President Obama a lot, hoping he would do things about this. And you're right. He has the mandate at the beginning of his seat. He had the Congress.
The whole world was behind
him. Why stop short? What is it? Is it politics? Is it really just his makeup?
Well, that's the question I try to answer in Listen Liberal. Yeah. You know, what brought this about? And what I finally decided was that Barack Obama is, as you mentioned, is very typical of the Democratic species. He is, you know, and they all have a very similar background. They all believe in very similar things. They believe in globalization. They believe in what they call free trade. They will often say they think that education is the solution to every possible social ailment, you know, from inequality to whatever, you know, everything. You know, just people need to go back to school. Mm-hmm. They need to get the right degrees, all this sort of thing. So his failure was very much, I think, in keeping with it wasn't him. Per se, it wasn't him, you know, some failure in Barack Obama himself. It's a failure of the party that he leads and the class, I should say, that party represents. And this is the critical point of the book,
right?
That the Democrats really aren't. You know, when I was growing up, I'm pretty old. I'm in my 50s. When I was a kid, they were the party of the middle class and of working class people, and they were very open
about
it.
Labor issues.
Yes, and there could be no doubt about it. That's what someone like Lyndon Johnson or Hubert Humphrey, that's who they were. That's what their entire lives were about. Or Harry Truman. Of course, I don't remember Harry Truman, but any of these guys, right? That's what their lives, that's what their entire politics were about. At some point in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, it was a gradual change. The Democrats dropped that part of their identity, and they instead became a party that represents a very different group, the sort of affluent white-collar professional class.
Well, let's take a break so we stay on time here, because when we come back, let's pick up there, because there's no better example than President Clinton as where this kind of changed. And you know, you talked about the early 70s in the book, but also about the Clintons and how they've ushered in a new wave. So we'll talk about, let's talk. Thomas Frank is my guest, longtime journalist, political analyst, historian, and he's the author of Listen Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People? We'll continue our conversation here right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest at the big table tonight, Thomas Frank, the author of Listen Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. We're talking about the Democratic Party, Democratic politics, and how it's changed over the years from a party that was interested in issues like inequality or social injustice and spoke for working people, and how that has changed to a different model. And Thomas, it's really interesting too, because you really paint a picture in the book, and it almost all comes back, the epicenter comes back to the Clintons, President Bill Clinton,
yes,
and how he changed the Democratic Party.
That's exactly right. Well, this is the transition in the Democratic Party took a long time. It began in the late 60s, the Vietnam era, advanced a little in the 70s, advanced quite a bit in the 1980s, but it came into flowering with President Bill Clinton. And this is a guy, if you go back and look at Bill Clinton's, he had, by the way, a populist style. We all remember that. He had this kind of common touch about him, you know, the Arkansas sort of guy. But if you look at the things he actually did as president, and he did a lot of little things, but if you look at the big things.
It's amazing when you put it in the book, you're like, you start to see a pattern.
It's weird. It's weird. Can I just go over it real quickly? Okay, so if I didn't read it, by the way, any of the Clinton hate literature. There's an enormous body of like conspiracy theory crazy stories, accusations. I didn't read any of that. I read books by his admirers, his allies, his friends, people in the cabinet who worked for him. And these are people who, by and large, think he was a great president. And according to them, he had five main accomplishments as president. The first one is NAFTA. The second one is the crime bill of 1994. The third one is bank deregulation.
Right.
The fourth one is what they called welfare reform. They really abolished the welfare system. And the fifth was a balanced budget. All five of these were Republican proposals. All five of them. Four of them ended in complete disaster. You know, the balanced budget is arguable. You can argue it either way. But the other ones, like NAFTA, I mean, they were promising this was going to, you know, bring, this was going to increase manufacturing jobs in America, increase American exports. It did exactly the opposite. It permanently gave management the upper hand over workers everywhere and over cities. They can always threaten to move to Mexico now.
The crime bill was mass incarceration.
Right. This is just unbelievable.
What we see today is a direct result of what happened.
And when you
start
digging in the history of that, it is shocking. And the details are there in Listen Liberal, but it is a horrifying story.
Right.
Bank deregulation, I mean, we don't really have to go into that. I mean, the only thing that's worth remarking here is that it wasn't just one or two bills that Clinton got passed at the end. It was all through his administration, deregulating the banks, deregulating them a little more, deregulating them some more, and then finally at the very end, doing away with Glass-Steagall altogether.
It's fascinating, too, and you make the point in the book, but it's fascinating that I mean, if you put all these together, it really does feel like an attack on the poor.
Yeah.
It feels like an attack on a working
class. They're rounding up poor people who smoke crack or whatever it is. You know, they're cutting welfare for single mothers. They're doing away with that entire program, and they're doing away with the laws on Wall Street. So one group of Americans is literally being liberated. The laws are being rolled back on them and on these other people. It is like the punitive, you know, the fist of the state, you know, the iron fist of the state is coming down on these other people at the same time. It's very interesting.
You know, it's
and he's
again,
a Democrat.
He's a Democrat.
I always have to remind foreign audiences. And this is our left in America. This is the party of left in America did this.
You point this out, and it's important to note because as the president, he does these things. But it's also the Democratic Party because with the DNC and everything involved, this is almost strategy 101.
Yes.
They
believe
change.
In these things.
Right.
That's exactly right. And so Bill Clinton was representative of this shift. He was not the author of it. He's not where it starts. But they decided, as I mentioned, beginning in the 70s, to distance themselves from the working class, distance themselves from unions, and especially to stop talking about the New Deal. They decided that the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt, this was a mistake. They needed to stay away from that, and they needed to identify instead with these affluent white-collar professionals. And so Bill Clinton looks at an industry, and Barack Obama, for that matter, and Hillary, they look at Wall Street, or they look at Silicon Valley, or they look at Big Pharma, and they see people very much like themselves and very much like the people who fill their cabinet. They see ideal Democrats. Have you ever heard the term creative class?
Yes.
Yeah, here in Chicago.
Right, of course. We hear it all the time. Right?
Yes. That is sort of the essence of the theory, the idea that there is this class of people, these affluent people with a lot of credentials, advanced degrees, and these people are they own creativity. Creativity is the property of a class, and you have to legislate to make this class happy. And you have to pass trade deals to make this class happy. And you have to reorganize your city to make this class love your city. You do everything for a class of people, but it's not the working class. It's not average Americans. It's these, the affluent, people with good taste.
And we'll talk about this, in the second half as well. But we saw how there's a turning point, maybe a turning point, and how we saw that a lot of Democrats, a lot of liberals supported Bernie Sanders. That came out of because at a certain point they say, we are seeing this trend and we want to buck against it.
Inequality is out of control and it affects people, their lives now. I mean, the kids coming out of college now, they're massively in debt. They don't see the bright future that was promised to them. You know, they're entering this kind of casualized labor market. You know, we all know about that. And it's they're a guy like Bernie promising free college and, universal health care. Yeah, it looks pretty good. And what's funny is, and by the way, I wrote a story for Harper's a while ago about the mainstream Democratic reaction to Bernie Sanders and why they hated him so much. He is a figure out of their past. He's like a Harry Truman or Franklin Roosevelt.
He doesn't fit what he's talking about.
But he's what they think they've put behind them. And it's like the return of the repressed or something. It's like a nightmare. It's like, wait a minute, we were done with that forever, and here it comes again.
Well, let's go back to the 90s and actually the 2000s. I mean, because maybe because of the presidency of George W. Bush, a lot of liberals and Democrats weren't paying attention to the change in the party, meaning there was, you know, there was something else to rally against.
Well, that's the nature of the two-party system, is that you get so caught up in the war against the other side. And this, by the way, happening right now. You get so caught up in resisting Trump or whatever that you forget to demand accountability from your own side. By the way, I should just point out here that everything I've said to you here is not me reading between the lines or trying to be clever with the text or anything. They boasted about this stuff. It's all backed up in Listed Liberal. The Democrats were very open about this transition. They weren't. This wasn't hidden. And we need to, you know, and we sit around and wonder, it's like inequality is out of control and the party of the, you know, the Democratic Party, not only have they done nothing about that, but they can't win elections. Working people are abandoning them by the millions. We need accountability from these guys. We need to look at what they've done and, if you ask me, put it into reverse. I mean, this is all of these things are tied together. The fact that they can't win an election, the fact that inequality is out of control, college costs, Wall Street, you know, these trade agreements, and Donald Trump sits in the White House right now. All of these things are connected, and they're connected through the Democratic Party.
Well, let's do this. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. And when we come back, I'd love to talk about, I mean, when you get to identity, when it comes to political identity of voters, and we saw so much poured into who's voting for Trump or who are the Trump voter. We hear that even today it makes the headlines. It's somehow attached to a quote-unquote Trump voter.
Yeah.
You make the argument, you know, that Trump voter is the old, a lot of the Trump voter is the old Democrat. I mean, the people
a lot
that
of
the
people
behind.
Voted for Obama, right. By the way, and this is very easy to show. You look at an electoral map, all these counties won by Obama that went for Trump in a huge way. It's shocking.
We'll talk about that and much more. Thomas Frank's my guest tonight. His book, Listen Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. We'll take a quick break. We'll get the news here on The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Thomas Frank, longtime journalist, historian, political analyst, and author. And his latest book, Listen Liberal, What Happened to the Party of the People, really takes a look at the Democratic Party and how it's changed over time to what we have today. And really, this is an exploration, if you will.
Investigative history.
Investigative history about the things that when you read it, you nod your head. I mean, you understand
that is high praise, sir.
Yeah, I mean, but it really is because the working class who you hear so much about being dependent on to win elections has just been completely overlooked by strategy.
Yep.
This is not accidental. This is strategy.
They talked about it openly. So the most famous example is NAFTA, which was obviously organized labor had done everything they could to get Bill Clinton elected in 1992, had, you know, like they always do, turned over their treasury to him, went door to door, you know, did phone banks, did all the things that they usually do. And then he becomes president. And one of his first things is to get NAFTA passed through Congress, which they, of course, strongly opposed and which went on to really damage organized labor in this country. And so they're very, very bitter about that. And when Clinton did this, when he got it done, the Democrats had a saying. By the way, do you remember, just a slight digression here, do you remember Jesse Jackson and the Sister Soldier incident where Bill Clinton set up the situation where he's at a Jackson event and he insults Jackson to his face while the cameras are rolling in 1992?
Okay.
And when they did that, and when they did NAFTA, there was a saying that the Democrats had, which is, those people have nowhere else to go. We can do whatever we want to them. We can hurt organized labor.
We've been talking about that for years, right?
They have nowhere else to go. And this is the genius of Trumpism. He gave these people somewhere else to go. But what he was saying about the trade deals especially appealed to these people. Look, you know, I've been touring the Midwest, speaking in union halls, speaking to a lot of working class people. They still regard NAFTA as the great betrayal. They are still bitter about it. They're still angry about it. And here comes Trump. You know, Republicans are generally free traders, you know, but here's Trump. This is his one, like, very unique selling proposition. Unlike every other Republican, he is criticizing NAFTA, criticizing it really harshly and criticizing the Trans-Pacific Partnership and all the other things. And poor Hillary, you know, she's totally knocked back on her heels by this because, you know, her last name is Clinton. She was Secretary of State. She had a hand in some of these trade deals.
And more importantly, the Democratic Party believes in this to this day.
Absolutely.
Right.
You look at someone like Thomas Friedman, who was one of President Obama's favorite newspaper columnists. You know, this guy would say things like, I don't even have to know what's in the trade deal to support it. I just, you know, that's sort of, it's like, that's their mindset. By the way, I live among these people in Washington, D.C. And the trade agreements are kind of a guilty conscience issue for them. They won't talk about it. When you bring it up, like at a dinner party or something like that, they deny, deny, deny. Oh, that has no significance. No one votes based on that. It didn't really hurt anyone. And you can prove that it did. And you can show them that. And then they're like, well, those people, you know, they didn't go to college. So they don't really deserve our sympathy. Or maybe they did go to college, but they didn't study the right subject.
They're going right back to the classes.
Endless, yeah, exactly. Right, endless ways of brushing it off. And their contempt for these people is just overwhelming. And these are Franklin Roosevelt's people. And the Democratic Party holds them in contempt.
Okay, let's talk about – I mean, I find it fascinating, too, because I feel like in 2008, the Democratic Party or Democratic voters, liberals – voted with their conscience to vote for a president in Obama. I mean, the hope and change, and we're going to do something different. This isn't the Clinton. This isn't the Democrats we know.
Yeah.
Now, after 8 years' time, and we already talked about it, it's the same.
Yeah,
and,
I know.
And out of that, which, you know, closer to home, I mean, you mentioned this is really the prototype for the Democrats that lead today. And I'm specifically talking about the Chicago mayor, Rahm Emanuel, comes from all of this. And you see
Bill Clinton's right-hand man.
And you see
on
all
of
the
issue.
Issues that we're talking about at the Washington, D.C. level playing out in the city of Chicago almost to a T. I mean, the idea of supporting the creative class here and building downtown and then some of the working class areas of Chicago or the poor are neglected and left
absolutely.
To their own devices.
That's right. That's right.
So, I mean, as you think about that, I mean, as you see big cities, and maybe we'll talk specifically about Chicago, there is a progressive movement. There are Democrats here who want to take it back. They want to play in the sort of Bernie Sanders
but
sandbox.
What you just described. So, I mean, you're exactly right. And that is what the Democratic Party looks like. And it is deeply unpopular. There's a reason it's wiped out, you know, across the country. Can I tell you a story? I was recently I did a story for The Guardian about voters in rural Missouri. I'm from Kansas City originally. And Missouri was not just a Democratic state at one time. It was profoundly Democratic. That was critical to who they were as a people. And, you know, Harry Truman is from there, Dick Gephardt, Stuart Symington. It is a very, very, very Democratic place, or was, okay? Today it always goes, it went for Trump. And a lot of these rural counties, Trump didn't just win, he won by 70%. 80%, these incredible totals. And so I go out to, and by the way, these are places where Obama was competitive. You go up to Iowa and there's all these counties that Obama, rural counties that Obama outright won in 2008. Today, wiped out. You know, the Democrats are wiped out. But you go out to these places. These are not prosperous people. They're not voting Republican because they're rich and they're lounging around the pool at the country club and they're friends with the Koch brothers.
Or even if they want to be.
That's not who they are.
Yeah, right.
These towns are crumbling. Their way of life is coming apart. The way I like to describe it is they had hope in 2008, and what they have today is desperation. And here comes Trump, and he appears to be or pretends to be speaking to that anger and that bitterness, you know, and talking about their way of life coming apart. And even his inaugural address was about deindustrialization, you know, and that is a big deal where I come from. And in the South Side, oh, yeah. And, you know, where are the Democrats in all this? They're the ones that are supposed to be looking up. Yeah. You know what their response to all this is? So they right now they're sitting around in D.C. or at some resort in Florida talking about they're having their postmortems about the election. And they had one about the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. It was looking at the map and looking at all these rural areas where they're wiped out. And you know what their answer is to what I just described? Walk away. Don't even compete in those. Save your resources and compete.
We saw that.
It's unbelievable. This is the party of Truman and Roosevelt walking away.
Are we seeing a sea change when it comes to political identity? And we've seen this in American history where Republican Party take on values of traditional Democrats and Democrats. Yeah. Are we seeing that now where Republicans might become the party for the working class, even though, you know, a lot of their base platform would have to change? But do you see that
Trump has said that. Trump said a lot of interesting things, you know, a lot of which is just, you know, nonsense. The man just blabs. But he did say that he wanted to make the Republicans into a working people's party. Now, that's brought forth bitter laughs from my lips when he said that. The Republican Party is, let's just be clear, traditionally the party of business. So the argument that I'm making, listen, liberal, the Republicans have always been the party of business, and they've always been most concerned. And Donald Trump is giving us a business government.
Sure.
You know, he says that all the time. The Democrats were once a party that was concerned more with average voters, but is today the party of a different business.
Class. Right.
The professional class. So they're both parties that represent very well-to-do interests, and it's like musical chairs. You have three classes, the business class, the professional class, and the working class. Three classes and two parties. Someone's left out.
All right. So, I mean, I feel like we have this conversation all the time. Thomas Frank's my guest in studio. We have this conversation about whether or not the two-party system is the right system for America. And we can talk about it ad nauseum on talk shows because it doesn't seem to change because of entrenched interests.
Yeah,
but
it's also the law.
Right, and the law. But we saw a little bit of an uprising in the election of Donald Trump, but also the push of Bernie Sanders. Do you feel that the issue of inequality and the issue of forgetting the working class has political currency for the future?
Oh, my God, yes, of course. But it's much beyond that. This is people see their lives falling apart. You know, the deindustrialization, all that stuff that and everybody knows it's happening, you know. I mean, the Republicans had their convention in Cleveland. When I was there, I took a tour of the east side of Cleveland. It's like, you know, people were driving around. This is where X factory used to be. This is where Y factory used to be. Yeah. This used to be a residential neighborhood. And, you know, houses, apartment buildings completely choked with vines. Look, the middle class dream in this country is ending. And people understand that, and people are furious. The problem is that our system doesn't give them great options. There are some hopeful notes, though. You mentioned Bernie Sanders. Here's a guy that comes out of nowhere. I live in Washington. He was, until very recently, regarded as a crank, as a marginal figure, someone people laughed at. He is the most popular politician in America today.
Not unlike our president. I mean, there was a time when people were laughing at him
course,
when he was
at
running.
Trump?
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. But look, there's also something hopeful in what you know, I'm not a big fan of Trump. I voted for Hillary, but there's something hopeful in what Trump did. You know, Hillary outspent him 2-1, and he beat her. And he beat – not only did he beat her, the most powerful political machine in the world, the Clintons. He also beat the Bushes. I mean, he wrecked the establishment wing of the Republican Party. And he's never had anything to do in politics before. That is amazing.
When we see how Trump set ablaze the Republican primary and apparatus and what he's doing even with Congress today, do you see that has to happen on the Democratic side? Do you think that from the Democrat side there needs to be someone who comes in and wrecks the party, not unlike what Trump did for the Republicans?
I don't use the term wreck. I use the term accountability. There has to be accountability. This is a long-term, slow-rolling disaster for these guys. And they think – I mean, I'm telling you, I live in Washington. I'm among these people. Their strategy – you know what their strategy is right now? Wait for Trump to screw up, and then we'll get in.
Absolutely, right.
And that might succeed. That might succeed. But that's not a strategy. That's just a – you know, they're just pretending. One of the points of genesis of this book where I started was – when it was explained to me at one of these D.C. dinner parties, someone was saying, well, you know, because of demographic changes in this country, the Democratic Party is going to win every future presidential election. This is about 2 years ago. So this guy said this.
Right.
We're going to win everything from now on. And we don't have to do anything. We don't have to serve anybody. We don't have to really do anything. It's just people vote their demographics. And there's more of us than there are of the Republicans. And we don't have to do anything. It's a stupid strategy because it lends itself to this kind of complacency, which you saw in the Hillary Clinton campaign. She thought all she had to do was reach out to affluent suburban Republicans, and she, you know, had this thing in the bag. And she got whooped. And it also doesn't reckon with Trumpism. Even if Trump screws up, there's going to be another Trump 4 years from now, 8 years from now. The Republicans have figured out how to beat the Democrats, and they're not going to let that go. You're going to have more Trumps and more Trumps and more Trumps. And the Democrats had better, you know— start looking around and figuring out what they've done wrong and how to win working class voters back. Instead, you know what? They curse these people. They're like, oh, darn you. They scold them. They better start figuring out what they're going
to
do.
Thomas Frank is the author of Listen Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, longtime journalist, political analyst, historian, writer for The Guardian, of course, also the co-founder of The Baffler.
Thomas Frank. Former Chicagoan.
And former Chicagoan. Thomas, thanks so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.